Laws regulating the sale of alcoholic beverages in Kentucky vary from county to county. Most counties are either wet or moist, allowing limited sales in certain communities or in places like restaurants, golf courses, or wineries. Several dozen counties and communities with them remain dry, but more officials and business people are pushing for the legalization of sales as an economic development tool. Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Those proponents say restaurant patrons, tourists, and other visitors want to be able to have a drink during their stay and will opt to spend their money at other sites that serve alcohol. Opponents say making legal sales legal leads to more social problems related to alcohol abuse like drunk driving, domestic violence, and underage drinking. Many of Kentucky's dry counties are in the western part of the state, and that's where our guest is based. Connie Hanner is a journalist who writes for various publications, and she joins us now. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Welcome to the program. Where are you?
I'm in Aurora, Kentucky.
And where is that? What county is that in?
That is in right in the center of Marshall County, who recently defeated their vote to make the county wet, both package and sales by the drink.
Now, there have been some local option elections as recently as this week in western Kentucky where the wet forces prevailed. City of Princeton and I believe a precinct in Sturgis in Union County. And then earlier this summer, Somerset, which is more in southern Kentucky, became the largest dry city thus far in Kentucky to go wet. You covered the wet dry vote in Marshall County. Was the campaigning intense for it?
The campaigning was incredibly intense. We had, geographically, if you look at Marshall County, to the east is Trigg County, which just went wet last year. To the west is Callaway County, where you could get liquor by the drink, but they just passed on the same day, July 17th, that you can now have package sales. And then you've got McCracken County to the north, which is also a wet county. So right now, Marshall County just kind of sits in this dry bubble, if you will, and still prevails. And I think what's most interesting about this particular vote is that people were so vehemently divided on the wet-dry issue. Out of the almost 24,000 registered voters in Marshall County, 55% turned out to vote on this issue. And the 13,117 votes cast in that election, the no votes prevailed by only 695 votes. So it was an extremely close election. And ironically, all the precincts that touched Kentucky Lake, which equates to the resort areas and the tourist areas, carried the wet vote. And the no vote then prevailed in the other precincts in Marshall County. And there's a total of 25 precincts in Marshall County.
Were both sides well organized? Was there a big campaign?
Yes, they were extremely heated campaigns, both publicly in the secular sections of the county and the sacred sections of the county. And the impression that I got was that we didn't have any undecided voters. People were either very much for it or very much against it. And I don't think really anyone did. It swayed anyone one way or another. I think what really it came down to in Marshall County was how well the groups were organized and how they were mobilized on the day of election to get people to the polls to vote. And I think that's what you really saw is that the folks on the no side, at least 9 of the polling stations were in local churches. And those folks were very interested in giving people free rides to the polling stations and getting them into the polls so that they could actually vote their choice on that particular issue.
This is hard to quantify, but I've always heard over the years that there's some sort of collusion between bootleggers and the religious community on defeating these types of things.
I am so glad you brought up the bootlegger issue because I was hoping we'd get an opportunity to talk about that. Ironically, if you talk to law enforcement was in favor of a wet vote, and the reason being that a wet vote actually diminishes drug-related activity in a particular area because the bootleggers not only have alcohol, but they also have drugs. And what law enforcement find is that if you legalize alcohol, fewer people are going to the bootleggers, so that you also have fewer alcohol and drug-related crime. And ironically, especially in the resort area, and I can speak to this because I live in this resort area, you do have more folks on the road. When you've got to drive 80 miles round trip to get a 30-pack of beer, and you've got a bunch of beard-up fishermen coming in off of Kentucky Lake, and they blast through that 30-pack, they have absolutely no compunction jumping in their pickup truck with the dog and the gun in the back and headed to Paducah to pick up another 30-pack. And they're about half in a bag.
So are the pro wet forces going to maybe try again later?
I think they're going to make an effort. They have to wait at least 3 years before they can bring the issue up again. But I will tell you that that they did not try this without suffering some personal issues. Unfortunately, in these types of votes, folks take this very seriously. They take it very personally, and I've seen some of the follow-up and some of the blowback from this vote. And people have been threatened. There have been very, very nasty sympathy letters sent. As I said, personal threats to folks. It's a very polarizing issue in an area because it speaks in these areas of their fundamental Christian majority, and those folks take that very seriously.
So are there any other wet dry votes looming in other parts of Western Kentucky that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of at the moment. As I said, you're going to see Marshall County probably in another 3 years, but let me suggest another statistic to you, and this may suggest give you some idea of, you know, the numbers that we're talking about. In neighboring Trigg County, which is joined to Marshall County by the land between the lakes recreational area, that is the location of the Egner's Ferry Bridge. If you recall, that went down in January and was just opened back up in May. That bridge connects Marshall to Trigg County. And Trigg County just recently, in the last year, went wet and provided alcohol sales to consumers. When the Egner's Ferry Bridge went down, the one liquor store in Trigg County lost 80% of their business.
Wow.
And that business was coming from Marshall County and the Lakes region. McCracken County, which is on the northern part of Marshall County, if Marshall County had gone wet, the liquor stores in the southern part of McCracken County anticipated that they would lose about 50% of their business. So it's big business. And as a big tax base and tax revenue generating in Trigg County, they allocated an additional 6% tax on alcohol sales, and they used that additional 6% to fund the purchase of new emergency response vehicles.
Before I let you go, and if you don't mind me asking, do you partake? Do you like to have a drink?
Absolutely. Are you kidding?
Where do you go?
Well, until Trigg County went wet, I would drive 80 miles round trip to Paducah. But let me tell you, when you go that far, you make sure you bring home a load. And don't go loaded.
I'll bet. Oh, yeah, drive safely. Connie, it's been good talking to you, Connie. What publications do you write for?
I write for the Examiner.com. I also have my own blog called the Artichoke, and then do some other freelance writing as requested.
Connie Hanner is a journalist in Western Kentucky, based in. She talks to us from Aurora in Marshall County. Connie, thanks for joining us today.
Rick, thank you. My pleasure.
Take care. This is Byline on WFPL. Now we're going to transition from the politics of alcohol sales to political pizza. The founder of Papa John's Pizza joined the debate over the federal health care law this week when he said it will force him to raise the price of his product and pass it along to consumers. And here to talk about it is WFPL's political editor, Philip M. Bailey. Hi, Philip.
Rick, how you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. So where did John Schnatter make these remarks, and how much will he have to raise his prices?
Well, it was in a conference call last week to shareholders. So it wasn't like Schnatter was calling a press conference to denounce the Affordable Care Act, which is also known as Obamacare in political language. He essentially was arguing before shareholders and trying to explain to them and trying to just put them at ease that according to their best estimates, the Affordable Care Act will cost the company somewhere between 11 to 14 cents per pizza. He said he's not supportive of the health care law, but like most businesses in the industry aren't. But he did say that their business model is ideal to absorb it if it isn't repealed. So they'll find a way to shallow out any of the costs and come up with some other core strategies as a result. And everyone knows in these parts that John Schnatter is a Republican fundraiser. He's hosted a number of Republican candidates in his home, including Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who came to Louisville not too long ago. He hosted a fundraiser last month for a congressional candidate, Brooks Wicker. So as a result of this, this is a presidential year. Mm-hmm. So any comment, whether in a public press conference or just a conference call to shareholders, will certainly get you attention. And he got some from Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert in his satire this week. And we have a clip of the introduction of, I guess, baking or roasting. Do you roast it? You bake a pizza? Baking Schnatter on his show.
The terrifying menace of affordable health care draws ever closer. But today, Americans finally got the wake-up call from one source they can still trust. Their pizza. Jim?
Will Obamacare make your pizza more expensive? Papa John's thinks so.
The CEO of Papa John's yesterday, John Shatner, came out on an earnings call and said in 2014, quote, our best estimate is that the Obamacare will cost about 11 to 14 cents per pizza.
14 cents! 14 cents! That's three times the value of a Papa John's pizza.
So you hear, and it's Schnatter, by the way. The reporter Shatner, from Fox News called him Schnatner. But so you see here, he's getting a little friendly ribbing here. And now Republicans, including Brooks Wicker's campaign, have come out in support of him, saying that he's just standing up to the law. That this law will create a problem for large businesses that have to cover costs of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, smaller mom and pop pizza places that have under 50 employees may not have to worry about this. But some people are, the LA Times, I believe, in an editorial, the Boston Globe, in an editorial, coming out and just basically saying that, listen, John Schnatter is a wealthy man. 11 to 14 cents isn't that much. He's just being a cheapskate. And that was another point that Colbert hit him on.
Now, don't get me wrong, folks. I believe every human being has a fundamental right to affordable health care. But at what price? There has to be a line we do not cross. And it's 14 cents. Because if we just sit idly by while everyone gets access to a doctor, today it's just 14 cents more a pizza. Tomorrow, it could be 3 cents more a taco. And I would rather be dead.
Just about out of time, but has Schnatter responded to any of this stuff, this backlash?
Well, WHAS political editor Joe Arnold got a statement from Papa John saying they certainly understand the importance of health care for employees. It matters to them, so this is not something they take lightly. But still, this is something that, John Schnatter has certainly felt the wrath of Stephen Colbert.
All right, Philip N. Bailey, thanks for joining us. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Haldet. Jefferson County's suburban fire districts, responsible for protecting nearly 187,000 homes and businesses, are tumbling toward a financial crisis that could force sweeping changes in the way the county fights fires. That's the lead paragraph in a recent Courier-Journal special report on the state of those fire districts. It was written by Jesse Halliday, who joins us now. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Let's start with a breakdown of fire protection in Jefferson County. We, of course, have the Louisville Fire Department, and then there are all these suburban departments. How many are there?
Right. There are 17 suburban districts. There's the Louisville Fire and Rescue, and then Shively has its own department. So in all in Jefferson County, we have 19. Two of them, Shively and Louisville, are funded through the general funds of those cities, and the suburban districts are set up in a special taxing district. So they collect 10 cents per $100 of assessed property value for each of the homes and businesses.
So why are they struggling financially?
Well, it depends on who you ask about whether they should be struggling or not. But essentially, we went from a volunteer system where you had very little, if any, pay for volunteers who were responding. And over the last 50 years or more, we're not a rural county anymore. Places that used to have very little population mm-hmm. now are developed and lots of homes and businesses. And so over time, each of the districts now has full-time paid career staff. That costs money because it's not only their salary, it's their pensions, it's their health benefits. And we all know that those costs have been rising.
So now some have already done some cost-cutting measures, but we look, you report that there could be more drastic measures.
Yeah, it depends on who you ask. I mean, in Linden, for example, Chief Russ Rakestraw has been pretty vocal about the fact that they are at a point where they may have to lay firefighters off. They have browned out a station from time to time when they can't pay overtime, when there's sick leave or vacation time they can't fill in on. We've seen some houses close. None of those houses to date have been houses that are staffed full time. So they're what they call volunteer only houses. That means nobody's ever actually sitting in them. They're just there with the equipment and then volunteers respond from home. So we haven't seen what I would call drastic cuts, but I think some of the chiefs are saying in the next 2 to 5 years, they are going to have to start making some of those harder decisions.
And there's no other stream of revenue, right?
No, it's all set by the state. It's all part of statute called Chapter 75 in the KRS. And that cap has been at 10 cents. Now, all of them didn't get to that cap until about 2005, I think, was the last one that got to the cap. But they cannot exceed that unless a change is made in the law. And they have lobbied in Frankfurt for several years unsuccessfully. And so there's not a lot of hope of that getting lifted anytime soon.
And some is a possibility that they could charge fees?
They are charging fees in some districts. In Linden, again, they have started charging if they go to a house fire. So you could get a bill in Linden if you have a fire and the fire department responds. As you can imagine, this does not sit well with residents who pay taxes for that service.
Of course, yeah. So, I mean, it's expensive to maintain a firehouse.
Sure. It's, I think Chief Frederick with Louisville Fire estimates it would cost about $1.4 million every year to run an individual fire station.
Now, firefighters here in Louisville, Jefferson County have been synonymous with the Crusade for Children and vice versa, but that hasn't affected their ability to raise money.
No, they do a great job every year of getting out on the corner and rallying people around that cause. I don't think that has changed at all. I don't think it would have to change if there were any structural changes either in how they operate. But clearly the tide has turned about talking about merger. I mean, we've never had merger because when city-county government merged in 2003, that did not come about because they exempted the fire districts. People feel strongly about their fire districts.
So is this problem being studied on a governmental level?
Well, there was, of course, the Merger 2.0 task force that Mayor Fisher put together, and there was a task force subcommittee that looked at fire and EMS. But after that, not a whole lot. There were some suggestions made, but not a lot of actual working things continuing. So Chief Frederick and some of the suburban chiefs have been meeting since January, going over possible scenarios, studying it, looking at it. They expect they'll have something to present to the mayor by the end of the year.
What's the response been to the piece? It ran, what, last weekend?
Sunday and Monday. Good feedback. I think it's a really complicated issue. I think people are trying to digest what this could mean. I wanted to do the piece. I've been looking at this for a couple of years, actually, because I don't think people generally know how their fire protection works. And so I hope people have a better understanding of that now and at least know what district they're in and who comes when there's a fire and what the issues for these guys are.
How's the Louisville Fire Department faring?
Well, they seem to be doing pretty well. There haven't been major changes there. They haven't had any reduction in workforce. And, they're funded through the general fund.
Yeah.
So their funding stream can be adjusted as they need. And they have had recruit classes, and I think they probably have another one. They had just graduated one, and we'll have another one soon.
Jesse Halliday has been writing about suburban fire districts in Jefferson County. You can read about it on the website, CourierJournal.com. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Byline on WFPL. We switch gears now, and Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief, has joined us in the studio. We had a little mishmash of things. We're going to start with Senator Rand Paul, Kenny, who we learned this week will speak at the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal, I think, for a junior senator from a state like Kentucky. Of course, Rand Paul kind of has an alter ego as leader of the Tea Party nationally, Tea Party groups. But it was a big, I think it's a big deal for the senator. A lot of Republicans in the state say it's a big deal. One that I talked to, John David Dyke, who's a political columnist at the Courier-Journal, you know, he kind of put out the challenge that find a state that has two more important senators than Kentucky right now, Mitch McConnell being the Senate minority leader and Rand Paul being a national leader of the Tea Party and now getting this RNC speaking spot. So Paul has kind of said that he's going to do a lot of contrasting between Obama and Romney. That's kind of typical of a speech, but it is an interesting move for Rand Paul.
I guess it's important the time and the day of the spot. Do we know when he's going to speak exactly yet?
They haven't said it yet, but with the RNC coming out and saying that he's going to get a spot, he's not going to be like the 3 a.m. speaker, you know, on Friday night when everybody's out at the bars in Tampa. He's going to have a role. Obviously, he's not the keynote. You know, he's not getting the nomination. You know, it could be as much as he's introducing someone else. And he gets 5 minutes or something like that. We don't know that yet. But the fact that they're putting him on the platform, that they announced that he was going to get a speaking slot, usually means that you're going to get a pretty prominent role, whether it's before or after Romney is introduced as the nominee.
You know, I guess these things can backfire. I recall of Bill Clinton when he was governor of Arkansas. I think it was at the 88 Democratic Convention. He droned on for so long, and then finally he said, in conclusion, and he got a big round of applause.
Yeah, sometimes they can go a little long. You know, Rand sometimes does talk a lot in his speeches. I remember his first Fancy Farm when in that U.S. Senate race, a lot of people were kind of fake snoring, fake falling asleep because you know, his speeches can drone on. They can not be really rowdy. And a convention is really looking to fire up the base. That's the definition of firing up your base is at a convention. But I think he's more refined than. I think he knows how to give a speech. I think he knows how to give some of those laugh lines. I don't expect a long, boring speech from Senator Paul this time. I think if he starts to go on and on, they might pull the curtain on him, you know, just get him off the stage.
Well, he and McConnell are both pretty good public speakers.
Yeah, they really are. McConnell's been at it for a little bit longer. He's more refined. But I think Paul is getting the idea that you can't stand up and tell everybody how the tax code has 2,000 pages and everything else. People just kind of, the eyes glaze over. So I think he'll have a good speech. And usually when you have a convention speaking slot, you can really propel yourself even bigger than you currently are. Of course, there are those rumors that Paul is looking at 2016 to take up his father's mantle as the presidential candidate in that year if Romney doesn't win. So this could be a spot that could raise his profile even more than it has outside of the Tea Party for a potential run like that.
We're talking with Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston on Byline. Paul also said this week that he there's some talk that he might be considered as a vice presidential nominee, but he says he hasn't been vetted.
No, not at all. It was a real quick no, he has not, which I don't think is too much of a surprise, but there was always some kind of talk, some rumors that when Paul endorsed Mitt Romney a couple months ago, while his father was technically still in the race, I guess his father technically still is in the race, even though there's no way he can get the Republican nomination. A lot of people started saying, well, why is Rand doing this? You know, why is he throwing his dad under the bus, coming out publicly endorsing Romney, stumping for him? A lot of Ron Paul supporters were upset about this. So they were wondering, what's Rand going to get? Is Rand going to get a vice presidential? Is he going to be on the short list? They didn't think he would be the actual nominee, but does he get flattered by being put on the short list and vetted? Obviously, that's not the case because they said he's not being vetted. Will he get a cabinet spot? Well, Paul kind of shot that down this week by saying, you know, if Romney wins, he expects he'll be in the U.S. Senate, which I noticed a real vice presidential candidate, Rob Portman, he started to say the same things now. I think Portman has a better shot of being in the Romney administration than Paul does. But Paul seemed pretty clear that he wanted to be a U.S. senator. He didn't really want to be in Romney's administration. So I guess at the end of the day, Paul gets a RNC speaking spot in exchange for endorsing Romney over his father.
Speaking of, Senator McConnell, he and Senator Paul are scheduled to speak at a Tea Party Tea Party rally, and the Tea Party hasn't fully embraced Senator McConnell.
No, they haven't. You know, a lot of national conservative Tea Party pundits have kind of criticized McConnell. Early on, when you went to these Tea Party meetings, when people, you know, when Rand or someone would get up there and say, you know, the Democrats are doing it wrong and the Republicans are wrong, and someone always out in the crowd would yell, and Mitch McConnell! So, you know, he hasn't had the warmest reception at these Tea Party things, but he is up for re-election in 2014. I think he's warming up to it. Obviously, this Tea Party rally with Paul will be fine for Senator McConnell. Paul seems to think that his fellow senator, the senior senator, will fit right in, is what he said at this Obamacare rally against Obamacare that the Tea Party is having in Frankfurt. So it'll be interesting to see kind of the how uncomfortable it can get, because I don't think a lot of the true Tea Party people in Kentucky really still have a lot of love for Kentucky's senior senator.
Speaking of McConnell's seat, you talked to Crit Llewellyn a few weeks ago about the possibility of her running for that seat, and she has says she's ruled that out, right?
Yeah, she absolutely shut that door. That was a couple of weeks ago. She says she's more looking at 2015. And so, you know, there's a lot of questions there. Who will run? Attorney General Jack Conway says that he's pretty much done with federal races. He's looking at the governor's race as well. I don't think any of the I don't think there's too many high profile Democrats who are actually jumping in there and saying, yeah, I'm taking a look at running against Mitch McConnell in 14. I think some of that has to do with they don't know who's going to be president at that time. If Barack Obama wins re-election, it'll probably be hard to knock off McConnell in that midterm. But if Romney's president, it might be easier to knock off McConnell. So I think people are just sitting and waiting, and, you know, probably by the time by December, you know, you might hear some real rumblings. It'll be interesting to see if any of the younger constitutional officers, maybe an Adam Edelin or Allison Lundergan Grimes, decides to make a real quick big jump at the start of their political careers.
You covered the fancy farm picnic. State Republicans are looking to fundraise off some comments, made by Speaker Stumbo, Democrat, that he supports and will vote for President Obama in the fall.
Yeah, Speaker Stumbo said it has never been for a loss of words and has never been afraid to speak his mind. The problem is that he decided to tell a lot of Western Kentucky Democrats that he supports a lot of what the president does. He does say he doesn't support everything, like his energy and his coal policies, but supports a great deal of what Obama has done, notably the health care law, and he says that he will vote for him in the fall. Unfortunately, there were a bunch of reporters and a few TV cameras that recorded and then posted that video online. So Republicans are basically, they were already trying to link state House Democrats to the president, try to nationalize it. Now they have reason to. The Speaker of the House in Kentucky says he will vote for Obama. They're hoping to, they put a $10,000 goal on it, but they've pretty much said, you know, the money thing is you just have to raise money in elections. This is really about letting everyone know what the Speaker of the House, who he supports in the fall and whose agenda. Of course, the Speaker will quickly tell you, yes, he's a Democrat. Yes, he's going to vote for the president. But that doesn't mean that he's going to all of a sudden adopt all of the president's initiatives and policies.
I know it's not a big election year, and then Fancy Farm was really down this year. I turned the TV on for a while it was going on, and I think I saw you and Bill Goodman and a few other people sprinkled around, you know, in front of the stage there. Not a big crowd.
No, not a big crowd. Quite a few seats, not really as crowded as it usually is, even with the media. But there were still some decent speeches. I would say Speaker Stumbo gave a pretty good speech. Mitch McConnell gave a pretty good speech. Kelly Whitaker, who's a Democrat who's running for a local state house race down there, she gave a pretty good speech. She was actually the last one to speak, so a lot of people had left by then. And, of course, House Minority Leader Jeff Hoover gave some decent speeches. Other than that, there was, you know, a lot of the lower local races got elevated. That just doesn't bring a lot of people from Lexington down to Fancy Farm when some of the main attractions are local races that they'll never vote for. But I think in the next couple of years, we'll see a lot better Fancy Farms, especially 13 through 16.
Well, the food is always good, though.
Yeah, that was the best part. The waits for the lines, the mutton and the pork, the barbecue, were very short. You know, people were telling me they've waited an hour and a half to 2 hours before. I waited in line about 20, 30 minutes, had plenty to eat. So I didn't have too bad of a day, even though there wasn't a lot of politicians there to kind of yell and be yelled at.
Before I let you go, let's talk about Governor Beshear just briefly. He's back now from his overseas trip.
That's right. He took a two-week trip over to France and Germany, I believe. This comes after just like a couple of months after he went to the east, you know, to Taiwan and over there in Japan for economic development. There hasn't been any news immediately that, you know, these French or German companies were going to invest more or expand. I think we might see that in the coming weeks if they brokered any deals while they were over there. But he's just kind of beaten the economic development thing, even though he's not running for re-election. We saw that a lot when he was running for re-election. Apparently, he's still going strong, taking a lot of trips, trying to bring jobs to Kentucky.
All right, and you're gearing up for the next General Assembly. It's not too far off.
No, it'll be here before we know it.
All right, Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio, Frankfort Bureau Chief. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Byline on WFPL. This week's landing of the rover Curiosity on Mars has generated renewed excitement about space exploration. And no one's been more eager to pursue some of the business opportunities created by space exploration than those in the legal profession. Say hello to the space lawyer. Space law has become an important component of the aerospace industry as more private firms try to get a foothold in space. And here to talk about it is Neil Ungerleiter, who's been writing about space law for FastCompany.com. Neil, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Good to have you. Where are you today?
I'm based over in New York City.
I was reading your piece, and it looks like as the commercial space industry continues to grow, pardon this awful pun, but the sky seems to be the limit for the space lawyer. What types of work are they and will they be doing?
Well, Rick, there are so many awful puns that can't be made about it. Frankly, I was amazed by the fact the field existed. I cover aerospace for Fast Company, and because of Curiosity, because of satellites, and especially GPS, which is, of course, based on a satellite, and private space flight, I've been meeting more and more space lawyers over the past year or two, and I found it incredibly interesting. The fact is, we are now dealing with these new amazing technologies and legal questions no one ever imagined, which is creating, well, a stellar field for lawyers. There's my bad pun.
So there's all kinds of fields. As I was reading your piece, of course, there's a possibility of space tourism, and I guess companies who offer, you know, spots to tourists need to have a lawyer on board just in case you know something goes wrong.
That's correct. I spoke with a space attorney named Doug Griffiths, who works primarily with space tourists, individuals who travel to space for recreation. And it turns out that airlines, and they work with insurance companies, have years and years of records to work with for insurance companies to make estimates with, legal frameworks to work with. But for recreational space travel, we have none of those things. So space lawyers find themselves improvising these new laws, these new forms, these new waivers for people who actually do want to travel in space.
And also we're looking at the possibility of territorial or sovereignty laws, I guess, and of course laws related to mining, if that becomes a possibility.
That's correct. What happened was the laws regarding sovereignty in space were written way back in 1967 during the Apollo era. And these laws basically dictated that countries could not claim asteroids or moons or planets in outer space. So the United States cannot claim sovereignty over the moon, China cannot claim Mars, and it goes on and on. But the flip side is, because it was written in 1967 before private space travel happened, private companies were not included. And we have now a legal gray area where private corporations and private firms could hypothetically claim sovereignty over asteroids or even plots of land on the moon. And as our technology reaches the point where mining asteroids becomes feasible, and odds are we will see it in the next 25 years, it's going to open some real legal questions.
And you mentioned James Cameron, the famous director, and a Google-backed asteroid mining company that's retained some lawyers. What's going on there?
That's correct. There's a company called Planetary Resources, which counts James Cameron as an investor, along with Larry Page and Eric Schmidt of Google, and Virgin's Richard Branson, which is attempting to mine rare minerals from asteroids in outer space. And they're working in a legal gray area because no one has actually, of course, mined in outer space. And they're working with lawyers to make sure everything is okay with the United States government, with the United Nations, with other international agencies. And it's crazy. They've created this amazing legal jujitsu. that claims asteroids are not celestial bodies covered by international law, because meteorites were not considered celestial bodies under international law, and because meteorites are asteroids that fell to Earth, therefore asteroids don't count, and they can claim ownership of asteroids in outer space.
So are there any, kind of veering off the subject a little bit, are there any minerals that we know about or precious metals or things like that that we know exist in various spots, but we haven't figured out a way to get to them yet?
There are. Platinum's most obvious example, but the biggest question are a group of minerals called rare earths. And rare earths are these, well, rare minerals that are used primarily in consumer electronics, in mobile phones, in computers, in high-definition televisions. And without them, your average iPhone or Android phone would cost well over $5,000. And these right now are only found on the planet Earth, in China and in Russia and in Canada in very small quantities. And it's a hope among many scientists that these elements, minerals, will be found on asteroids much more easily and much larger quantities than on the planet Earth.
Neil Ungerleiter has been writing about space law for FastCompany.com. Neil, good to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
We'll be back with more in a moment. Aaron Keene will return with our arts segment in just a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett, and it is time for our arts segment. Aaron Keene is here with a special guest. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick. Thanks. Yes, they walk among us, and we never know, never suspect. That's from the beginning of Jeffrey Skinner's The 6½ Habits of Moderately Successful Poets, subtitled A Self-Help Memoir. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
The 6½ Habits of Moderately Successful Poets is published by Saraband Books here in Louisville. And I would say moderately successful poet, yes. 5 collections of poetry. The latest is Saltwater Amnesia. Jeffrey, you're also a playwright and a professor of creative writing at the University of Louisville.
That's right.
And modest, moderately successful, not too.
Moderately modest, yes. That too.
So in the introduction to this book, I was struck by the description that this is a book for all, for who may be curious about the actual as opposed to the fantasy life of the contemporary American poet. Just to start off, what are some of those fantastical misconceptions that you've heard people have about what it means to be a living, breathing poet?
Well, first of all, I think not many people believe there are poets anymore. I think most people think that they died off around the time of Robert Frost. But those people that do have some ideas about poetry believe that poetry still has to rhyme, and that if there's a poet somewhere, they must be living a semi-fabulous kind of life, not the kind of life of Tom Cruise, but something where there's a lot of attention, and there is not much attention at all to poetry. And a lot of it is work, is day by day writing, not always being inspired. So that part of it, I think, is not really on the top of people's minds either.
Yeah, poetry is writing is hard work. That's the refrain you hear from most books like this and interviews with writers where they say, you know, it's not all fun and games and inspiration. It's the daily grind of sitting down and putting pen to paper until finally you create something that.
Right. Although writing poetry is fun still. I mean, it's much better than a lot of the jobs that I've had. And it's not really a job at all. It's a vocation. It's a calling. And that's part of what I'm writing about in the 6.5 practices.
Practices
because we can't steal any words from another book with a similar title.
Ah.
So I had to change every word in the title, the 6.5 Practices of Moderately Successful Poets.
6.5 also.
6.5, yes. Well, there's only a half of one at the end.
Well, we'll touch on that in a second. But speaking of work, you have quite an interesting professional background, I think, for a professional poet, that you started your career as a private investigator.
That's right. My father was an FBI agent, and when he left the agency, he bought a private investigative business. So if he had been a baker, I probably would have baked bread, but he was a private investigator, and so that was the family business, and that's the work that I did from the time I was around 19 until I was in my mid-early 30s.
Wow, so this is quite a different background from moving straight from undergrad into the MFA, like, you know, like...
It is. Too. I took some time off, and I'm glad that I did, and I've been in the business world, and I've been in, you know, the private world outside the institutions. And I'm glad, and I think that it has done something for the voice of my poetry, at least something that I like, because I have not spent my entire life in the academy.
Well, so you brought an excerpt to read.
I did. This is an excerpt from a story called The Background Check, in which I'm a private investigator. A low-rent walk-up apartment building. When I knocked on the door, a man wearing a T-shirt peered out over the safety chain. I told him my business and held up my private investigator ID. He opened the door. I walked in and heard the door close and lock behind us. The place was a derangement of dirty clothes, stacks of old Life magazines, encrusted fast food containers, and guns. There were rifles and pistols mounted on most of the available wall space, and then a card table covered by a white towel in the middle of the room lay the pieces of what I guessed to be a dismantled machine gun. The room smelled of linseed oil and Chinese food. When I looked at the man, he was smiling at me, his hands in the pockets of paint-spattered black jeans, and I understood that he had been looking at me, looking at the guns. His T-shirt was the sleeveless kind, and I took note of the well-developed shoulders and the extreme whiteness of his arms, wonderbread white, almost the same color as his shirt. You're not a cop, are you? No, just a citizen. You sure? Sure, I'm sure. Here, have another look at my ID. He took it from me and studied the picture. He looked at me, then back at the photograph. He moved to the window and held the ID up to the sunlight. He casually plucked a German Luger from the wall and held it down by his side while he studied the picture in his other hand. He looked at me. I hate cops. They're no big pals of mine either. Is that right? His eyebrows lifted in curious surprise. Absolutely. I never met one I liked. I'd kill a cop if he came into my house, he said.
Wow. Poetry comes from dangerous roots. So how does this background in private investigating, how does this tie into the overall self-help memoir style of the 6.5 practices?
Well, I think that as a private investigator, you have to be alert and spontaneous at the same time. That as the story goes on to say, I had to use my mind and my mouth to get myself out of a pretty tense situation. And that happened quite frequently. So I had to invent myself sort of continuously as a private investigator. There's quite a bit of prevarication going on in that business, I have to say. it's in a good cause, but there is. So that taught me to use my imagination in ways that were good for obtaining a kind of goal. It was goal-oriented imagination. And I think that that feeds into poetry. Also, being a good observer, which one has to be as a private investigator, that is an essential part of poetry also. Seeing the world, being able to describe it accurately.
Do you find yourself inventing yourself over and over again as a poet?
It's a bad habit. yes, I do. I wish that I wrote, I mean, I think I have a strong signature in my voice and in my poems, but I do write a different kind of poem, and I do try lots of different things. So I am a kind of a little bit of a chameleon.
Well, you grew up in Levittown, New York.
I did.
Yeah, and especially, I guess, living and writing in Kentucky, people talk about place a lot and the place that you're from informing your work so much. What about you in Levittown? What if Levittown is in your work?
I think a kind of New York attitude, perhaps. It was maybe 40 minutes, 30 minutes from New York City. So when we went on field trips, it was to the Statue of Liberty and to the National, and to the Museum of Modern Art and to that kind of place. And I grew up absorbing the kind of New York attitude, you know, you could think of as straightforward, fairly blunt, very little frills, that kind of thing. There wasn't much that was highly wrought about being a New Yorker at that time. Maybe that's what I've taken. I think I've taken from, you know, I've lived in Kentucky now for 22 years or 23 years, so I think I've absorbed some of Kentucky, too, as one always does from a place. But I won't. You know, when I get tired or angry, the New York comes out in my voice. My accent comes back.
My mom's like that, too.
Yeah, so watch out.
Well, the theme of hard work does run, and yet at the same time, fun runs through this book. And one thing that when I was reading it, I was really sometimes you come across these passages where you think, "Thank you for the permission for this." When the line, "I have practiced only the minimum amount of discipline necessary to live and write," when you're studying to be a writer, and then when you're a novice writer, you go looking for these kinds of practices and the words of advice from poets who have been there, and you encounter a lot of things like William Stafford saying, "You got to get up at 4:30 in the morning before everyone is up, and you got to do it every day," and it's terrifying.
Humbug, I say. I'm with Whitman. I loaf with my soul and loaf. That's what I like. Good old Walt. But it's the thing is, poets, I think, if you are the real thing, they want to write.
Yeah.
I want to write. There is a sense in which I'm driven to do it. I mean, here I am, a grown man, in middle age at least, and I'm still writing poems. It's really not done. You know? So I don't think I would do it unless I had.
Life.
No, it's not a sensible life at all. What am I doing writing poems? You know, I'm a grown up.
Right. Well, and then there's also the very, what I think of as the very different spheres of the poetry ecosystem, which are creating the work, doing the writing, the creation, and then the business side of it, getting published, getting your work out there, getting your books out there. And that's the part that people are hungry to know more about, the demystification.
I say quite a bit about that in the book, and I give advice about that because I think people need advice about that. And the central kind of advice, item of advice that I gave is to separate the two, to separate your poetry writing and the promotion of your poetry writing, which is a business.
Yeah.
And to keep that separate. It's very difficult to do because poetry is so intimate and it has something to do with our personal soul. So it's hard to take a rejection and think of it as just, another day at work.
Yeah, I mean.
But you must.
The art world, I think every art discipline is like this. When you talk to actors and auditions, they talk about this as well. The rejection after rejection after rejection, which you, if you let that sort of seep into the creation part of your work, you start to second guess yourself, which is.
You got to be tough to be an artist.
Yeah.
You really do.
But you must be sensitive as well.
I'm very sensitive. Can't you tell?
Absolutely. So of these 6.5 practices, which one is the one that you feel has served you the most at its core?
I think takes the long view. I think that as an artist, one needs to take the long view to think that the career just doesn't depend on the next poem or the next play or the next piece of writing. It depends on day after day. Putting in the time, hoping that something happens, but if nothing happens for a while, just continuing to believe that you can do it and that it will come back. And it does. And that, if your career is in a down place, just continue. As Woody Allen says, I still have to play the clarinet, every morning. He has to practice. So I practice my clarinet. I write every day, no matter what's going on in my career or how far it goes. I'm kind of stuck anyway, and I think a lot of writers are. This is what I do. So no matter what happens, I got to do it. But that's the long view. And it cuts out a lot of nervousness, I think, about what's going to happen tomorrow or next year to my career.
So when there's a MFA or not MFA little intake quiz in your book as well. Tell
yes.
us a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, there are... When I was starting out, there were like 6 or 7 or 10 MFA programs in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's now 400 or 500 of them. And one wonders, given that not many books of poetry are sold, at the number of people who want to write poetry. It seems like there's a lot of people who want to write poetry, not many who want to read it. It's an odd kind of place that we're at. So I think that it's fine to go to an MFA program, and I encourage students to do it. It's 2 years or 3 years of devoting yourself to the art, and there's can't be anything wrong with that, and it's never a waste. Writing a poem is never a waste of time, I think. On the other hand, I'm just not sure. I have two minds about MFA programs and how many more we need. Do we need 2,000 of them? I mean,
A new one is born every time you hear a bell ring. An MFA program gets its accreditation.
That's right, Clarence.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I feel like if you want it, go for it. But not every writer needs it. So, and that's where it seems like the big popular argument comes down to: do you need an MFA or not?
I think you need an MFA if you want to teach.
Yes. Yes.
Otherwise, you don't.
Right. Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for being here with us today. The 6.5 Practices of Moderately Successful Poets.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you both. That's all the time we have for today's Byline program. For more information about topics discussed today or to listen again, visit WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Hallett. Have a good weekend.